Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab, and we're going to go back now to the final segment in our show about endings, recorded live at the Paramount Theater in Seattle. All right. We're going to close the show up. We're going to shift the mood a bit. We're going to close out this show and our tour with a very different kind of ending.
Yeah, because unlike dinosaurs, you know, dinosaurs have no idea what's ever going to happen to them. But in this story, we have an ending in which the enders can see what's coming. It's coming right at them. Not fast, but in this case, very slowly. So can you guys hear me easily?
Yes.
Easily. Okay, good.
We want to introduce you to two guys, Chris Jones and Dan Moran. They're both actors in Manhattan. Both been doing it?
About 30, 40 years.
30, 40 years.
Plays, movies, you name it.
Done five Woody Allen films.
Lottie Gosler's Pantomime Circus.
Julius Caesar on Broadway with Denzel.
Moonstruck.
The Cher movie?
Yeah.
A lot of Shakespeare, a lot of comedies.
They've worked pretty much everywhere there is to work. As it happens, I know this story because Chris, one of the actors, is an old friend. We met in a high school musical, actually, many years ago.
Oklahoma?
You think everything is Oklahoma.
I don't know. I don't know musicals.
Anything goes.
In any case. Our story for both Chris and Dan begins...
10 years ago.
Dan was on stage, big stage, Washington, D.C.
I was doing Streetcar.
As in Streetcar Named Desire. And he was playing the lead role, Stanley Kowalski. You know, the guy that Marlon Brando made famous for yelling...
Hey, Stella!
That guy.
And, the woman playing Stella said, it's really sexy how your left arm doesn't swing when you walk. It's kind of like animalistic. And I said, well, that's cool, so I used it.
You thought, all right, if it works, it works. I'll just play the character that way as a guy whose arm doesn't swing.
But after the show ended, I was walking down the street to Manhattan, I thought, why isn't my left arm swinging? What's going on?
Now, Chris... So, right out of around the same time, he was in Delaware shooting a film.
A movie by M. Night Shyamalan.
Kind of a great movie, if you ask me.
Called The Village.
There are marks on the door.
I played Adrian Brody's father.
And while getting ready in wardrobe one day, he noticed...
that I had a slight tremor occasionally. Difficult time buttoning buttons with my right hand. I thought I had a pinched nerve in my neck, and I went to see an orthopedic guy, and he said, you should see a neurologist.
I went to a doctor.
And he said, very gleefully, I think, you've got Parkinson's.
Why? And he had to run a deficit of Parkinsonians?
He was pleased that he was able to help me out.
He nailed it.
Now, Parkinson's... If you ask an expert, which we did.
Cheryl Waters, Columbia University Medical Center.
Parkinson's is a very mysterious disease.
I'm not sure what to think about it now because it keeps evolving and changing.
Some people, according to Dr. Waters, when they get the disease, nothing happens.
Nothing. They come with tremor and they die with a little bit of tremor and nothing else ever happens.
But in other cases, for some reason...
it could wreak havoc.
Because sometimes, and... doctors really don't know why this is the case. Sometimes the disease will just start to march through the brain. It'll begin deep down.
Low down in the brainstem.
And then it will gradually inch its way upward. First, it'll attack this little cluster of cells.
In the middle of the brain that control movement.
And that's when you start to see the shakes.
And then little by little, there's a progression.
A progression up.
A migration.
To the surface.
To other areas of the brain that control thinking, memory, concentration.
And in those cases, the disease...
it is inexorably progressive.
So you got these different kinds of Parkinson's. One that sleeps, one that goes on the rampage. The problem is, when you're diagnosed, you can never quite be sure which kind you got. Because
for the people in whom it spreads, it can take decades.
When he said you have Parkinson's, did you feel like you were in trouble at the time?
No, that was a joke. That was a joke. This is nothing. I'm fine.
In the beginning, Dan and Chris didn't really worry a whole lot about this because they didn't have to. In fact, Chris...
When I first was diagnosed and was performing...
He was doing a lot of Shakespeare. And you know, if his hand ever started to shake a bit...
It was always nice to have a nice big cloak or cape for me to wear to hide my hand behind so that the audience wouldn't see the tremor.
Truth is, it didn't happen all that often. Wasn't much of a deal. Chris kept acting. Dan kept acting. And in both of them, their Parkinson's seemed to be the kind that stays asleep.
For 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 7 years. But then, after 8 years, it just woke up.
I just found out that it got harder and harder to move.
Dan says he's not quite sure when it happened, but suddenly his limbs were aching all the time. And that easy control that you have over your body as you're walking down the street where all the limbs are moving together and you don't have to think about it. For him, that started to disappear. He'd have to think about each leg, each foot independently.
Left foot, one. Right foot, two. Left heel, one. Right heel, two.
Chris, he would actually have these moments where he would try to move his arm, where his brain would basically say to his arm,
"Move!"
But his arm would just sit there.
Stuck.
Like it wanted to move, but it just somehow couldn't.
I would freeze on stage. It was a nightmare.
And as things progressed, Dan would have these moments in rehearsals where suddenly he would just go blank.
Like I'd done this TV show on FX. I had one scene where I couldn't remember five lines. I just couldn't remember five lines. We'd shot all night on this. I'd go to my dressing room, I'd do the lines, I'd come back out, I'd blow it.
Now, this isn't an easy situation for anybody, but if you're an actor, if you're somebody who has to inhabit a character with a different rhythm than yours, a different flow, use your body to do that, which is how you pay the rent, for actors, Parkinson's is just awful because it kills their craft.
Well, your face becomes a mask. So you haven't got your face.
And without face, you don't have flow.
The way I liken it, if you take a pebble and you throw it into a pool of water, it goes, and there's a ripple that goes, concentric circles go out from the impact. If you take me, my body, myself as an actor, and you throw a pebble into my pool, it goes thud. There's no fluidity, it just stops.
I mean, once I opened up to the acting world, I had Parkinson's. My agents dropped me. The calls pretty much stopped coming, and that was that.
But then one night, something happened.
How did this idea come up?
Well, it was my first idea, I guess.
Your brilliant idea.
Thank you, buddy.
Now, we should say that these two guys, Chris and Dan, they've actually known each other for years.
The two of you met doing what?
A Month in the Country.
Which is a classic play.
On Broadway.
And Dan explains it was late one night. He was having insomnia, which is a usual side effect of the medication he has to take. And he was just looking around for something to read. And he grabs this play off the shelf.
Yeah, I just picked it up.
It was a play by Samuel Beckett.
Endgame. A play in one act.
And he starts reading.
Characters, ham. Clove.
I mean, this was a play that he knew. He had read it before. But that night, it seemed to talk to him in a way that was totally new.
Bare interior, gray light.
Right from the start.
It started off with a guy shuffling on stage. Clove goes and stands under the window left. Stiff, staggering walk, shuffling around. He looks up at window left. He turns and looks at window right. And I said, oh yeah, I know shuffling.
He thought, huh. Feel this guy.
Can't sit, can't get comfortable.
Seemed familiar to him. And then on the next page,
ham stirs.
Another guy enters the scene.
Very red face, black glasses.
Also in bad shape.
This guy is stuck in this wheelchair, can't walk anymore. He takes off his glasses, wipes his eyes, his face, the glasses, puts them on again.
So here you got these two guys. One can't sit, one can't stand. They're stuck in this little room with these two windows that look out. And outside those windows...
Either due to an asteroid, a nuclear holocaust, what used to be green is now gray.
Like a wasteland.
Is there anyone alive out there, do you think? Or...
No.
No.
Outside their window, they can see the ocean, but it seems to have stopped moving.
There are no waves.
Now, endgame. That's a term that comes from chess, and it refers to that moment in the game when there are just a few pieces and just a few moves left.
The last few moves before the inevitable outcome.
It's not the end, it's the point right before the end, and it's the place where you become aware of the end for the first time. Dinosaur can't do that, but these two characters...
They've run out of everything. Out of painkiller.
Yeah, the painkillers are gone.
Out of biscuits.
And they have that awful awareness. And now they have to deal with it. Like, here we are.
What do we do? How do we fill up the time on this rock hurtling through space?
The more I read it, it just felt like Parkinson's to me. Being locked in a room was my body. I'm not getting out.
There's no cure.
I'm not getting out of this room.
And then, on page 3, one of the characters, a guy named Ham, stops what he's doing and he says...
Enough. It's time it ended. And yet, I hesitate. I hesitate to end.
And Dan says something about that line, and yet I hesitate to end. Just flipped a switch for him.
Screw these people that won't hire me. Because I've got this fucking little disease that makes me shake or talk funny.
I don't need those people.
No.
Next morning, he calls Chris. Chris, describe the call. You're sitting there, and one day the phone rings. Is that
how
this happened?
Yeah, he says, how'd you like to get together and take a look at Endgame? And
Chris remembers thinking, I don't know.
I'm not sure if I'm up to it.
It's a 70-minute long play. It's got 12,000 words.
The material is monumental.
But they thought, no, let's just, no pressure. Let's just meet at each other's apartment. So one day Dan would read one part, Chris the other part. The next day they'd switch. They did this for almost a year, the two of them, in each other's living rooms, reading the play, back and forth. Until finally, they contacted the Beckett Estate and got permission to put on one live performance in New York.
We decided Chris is having more trouble with his movement than I am. I have more trouble with my speech than Chris is. So I thought, well, why don't I take on the part with all the speech? And you got trouble with moving, so you do the part with all the movement. That makes sense.
So you both leaned into your weaknesses.
Yes.
Well, so the obvious question is, why would two people in danger, and in more danger over time, why would you decide to spend time staring at that danger straight in the eye? Like, that's just a weird thing to do.
It's the only way to do it. That's the only way to do it. And I can't, like, go through the rest of my life being afraid of this fucking disease.
When he said that, I didn't quite understand what he was saying. Because if you are legitimately afraid of something, why would it make you less afraid to stare at its details? That would make me more afraid.
I mean, I don't know if it's about fear, really. I think it's about knowing.
Knowing what? Knowing...
Just knowing where you are, like where you really are, you know? It's like a kind of journalism in a way. Like, I can imagine if you've got this thing that's been stealing from you for 10 years, right? Stealing your body, it's stealing your craft. At a certain point, you want to know, like, where am I? Am I past it? Is the end already happened for me? Am I broken? Or do I have something left? I mean, it's sort of like in one of the Beckett plays, not this one, but an earlier one, there, a character waltzes onto stage and he says the following two sentences. I can't go on, I will go on. Mm-hmm. It's like those two sentences, contradiction, right? I can't go on, I will go on. It's almost as if Dan is trying to figure out which sentence is he. Is he the I can't, is it done? Or is he the I will, like he's got something left. And the only way to know that is to look at the thing that's posing the question.
Yeah, but what if you put on the play and you find out you get the wrong answer? You find out, I can't. This is what Chris was worried about.
The big issue for me was... What happens to my sense of myself if we get to the performance stage of this project and it turns out that I couldn't cut it?
And yet, they go on. After a year of reading this play back and forth in their living rooms, Chris and Dan decide, okay, it's time to find a performance space. time to hire a director?
Oh, they used to come dragging their asses into rehearsal, looking like, these guys aren't going to be able to go from here to there.
That's Joe Gafazzi, Chris and Dan's director.
Shaky and Wiggly, as I used to call him.
He's known him for years. You did not call him that.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, because that's what they were doing.
Now, Joe says Dan and Chris were two of the best actors he has ever worked with, and oddly enough, in this case, their disease could be an asset.
I believe that, because they're halfway home.
I mean, they could feel what Beckett's characters in this play were feeling better than anyone.
I never felt for a moment this wasn't going to make the play better.
If they could get through rehearsals.
Easier said than done. Take the problem with the medication. Now, both of them, when they're peaking on their meds, they are sharp and they're clear, focused, but when the meds start to taper away, they get cloudy. So the hope was, if they were going to rehearse together, they'd have to time it just right so that they pop their pills at the right time and rise together, get clear, and then taper off together at the same time.
The medication gives you about an hour and a half window.
Might be just enough time to run a few scenes. Problem was,
it wouldn't always work. Some days I'd walk in.
And Dan says even when he timed it just right, sometimes the medication wouldn't take.
I would be completely locked up.
Chris would be right in the middle of a scene doing really well and then get so tired he'd have to sit down.
Didn't have much stamina.
So it's like, let's just turn around, go home, or break out the mattresses.
Which sometimes, Joe says, they actually did.
We'd lay around on the floor, we just do something.
You'd lay around on the floor?
Yeah. I said, let's lay down. Why don't we lay down and do the lines laying down? That's actually a great exercise.
Point is that a lot of times rehearsals were a bust, and as they got closer and closer to the performance day,
Dan would say, take me aside and say, you know, I got to tell you, Joe. This is okay, but I'm scared out of my mind. You know, scared out of my mind.
It sort of became terrifying.
And I said, well, that's good. You know, since when shouldn't we be scared, right, Dan?
And then he'd remind Dan of a basic law of the theater. Terrible rehearsals make great performances most of the time. But they knew this was a very different situation.
Very different.
We're at 15.
Oh, thank you, baby.
Then came July 13th, last year.
The people are coming.
The night of the performance.
Ruthie? Yeah? You got our understudies?
A couple minutes before the show, Dan calls for the so-called understudies and then runs to the back door to smoke a cigarette.
I'm looking out this door and having a cigarette where I've looked out and had a cigarette many times before. Everything seems familiar. But I don't belong there. I feel like I'm... Like, what am I doing here?
He says he kept thinking, how did I think I could do this?
I mean, I'm going to fuck it up. I'm going to forget lines. I'm not the character. I'm not fully the character. I haven't rehearsed enough. I haven't had enough rehearsal time.
And he says he actually walked out the door. Got about halfway out, because he's at that moment he was thinking, you know, that question, can I or can't I? I've got my answer, and I'm about to go out in front of hundreds of people and show them nakedly that I am broken, that I can't do this, that the end has already happened. Then he thought,
I'd started this ball rolling and I couldn't stop it.
So
no.
Just do what you have to do.
Just start at the beginning, go until the end, and then stop.
Okay, so the play begins with Dan in the middle of the stage. He's asleep in a wheelchair, covered by a sheet. Chris paces around behind him, sort of shuffles about, looks out those windows, mumbles.
It started off okay. Chris was very worried about getting a laugh.
First sound he makes, he gets a laugh.
Right from the start, the audience got Beckett's humor. That was a great, great relief.
But then, the thing Dan feared most happened. In one of the big speeches of the play, he went blank.
Oh my God, what's my next line? I lost a line.
He says he stared down at his feet for 20 seconds, and then his wife Ruth fed him a line, and he went on. That was one moment. But there was another moment. A series of moments, actually, that were entirely different. It began...
Finished! It's finished!
Just after Chris's opening monologue, as Dan begins to speak.
Can there be misery loftier than mine?
So I tried my damnedest to just stay with the story, moment by moment.
Enough. It's time it ended. In the shelter, too. And yet, I hesitate. I hesitate to end. Yes, there it is. It's time it ended, and yet I hesitate.
And Dan says, as he was up there making that speech about how it's time to end, and yet he hesitates, a funny thing happened.
You know, my performance muscles started to take over.
His body loosened up. His legs, his arms, his mouth, suddenly they were under his control in a way they hadn't been for months. He could move them without thinking.
It's quite remarkable.
Cole, yes. Have you not had enough?
Yes!
We were able to do things on stage.
Of what?
For this huge stretch of the play, it was like the disease was gone.
That's always the way at the end of the day, isn't it, Chloe?
Always.
It's the end of the day like any other day, isn't it, Chloe?
Looks like it.
What's happening? What is happening?
Something is taking its course.
And then?
There we are. There I am. That's enough.
It was over.
It was amazing. And then I remember walking backstage and Chris and I just burst into tears. We just started crying. It was not so much about the release of doing it, but I think it had more to do with family. Our kids and our wives and some really good friends could see that there's still some kind of possibility. And I do believe that it was mixed with feelings of like, oh God, I'm gonna miss this.
For me, a lot of times when I commit to a project, one of the things that I'm sort of curious about is who will I meet in the person of me in this project? Who will I find in the room when I work on the material? And I was pretty proud of who I found on this one.
There's something in this story that it speaks to all the things we feel about endings. I mean, obviously it hurts to end. As Dan says, and this is a line that gets me every night, oh God, I'm gonna miss this.
But there's also something in what Chris says, that if you stare unblinkingly at the truth, you sometimes find something in yourself that you hadn't seen before, which is in its way a new beginning.
And so it's time.
Yeah, it's time to end.
You know, we've never quite figured out how to end this show about endings. Except maybe to follow Dan's simple advice.
Start at the beginning, go until the end, then stop.
Yeah. And so, ladies and gentlemen, we've started at the beginning, we've gone to the end, and now we will stop.
I'd like to go on a little bit longer, just a little bit.
All right, then. Reggie, take us out. this moment right here, this moment, no one had a better view of this moment than me. Because I'm sitting there behind the desk. You get out from the desk, walk to the side of the stage, get the hyper-realistic T-Rex dinosaur, masterfully puppeteered by Mr. Myron Gousseau, and you guys have like a breakdance dance-off in the middle of the stage. 2,500 people just do not know what they're looking at because they're seeing Robert Krulwich bust a move. I mean, like, bust a move in that, like, you know, young MC, like, 1995 way. Bust a move. It's like, it was amazing. It's so amazing, in fact, that you have to go to the website right now, radiolab.org/live, and watch it. I also shot multiple videos from behind the stage.
Like, what are you doing? Because I was like,
I can't believe I'm seeing this. I can't believe I'm seeing this. It was so... It was the most joyful thing I've ever seen. And I want to thank you for that, Robert, for allowing me to watch you do that night after night. And for Reggie for creating the music, and for Sarah Lipstate, Darren Gray, Glenn Cochi, Keith Scratch. It was just awesome. It was awesome. That, plus the musical apocalypse, I will never forget those moments. I also want to thank our sound geniuses, Jill Dubuff and Dave Sanderson and Dylan Keefe, and to our tireless, fearless, and fear-inspiring tour manager, Melissa O'Donnell, and to the woman without whom any of this would have been possible, our director, Ellen Hoare.
Yes.
I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Thanks for listening. Pit row 1, seat 10. Are you ready?
Yes. Apocalyptic... was performed live at the Paramount Theater in Seattle, Washington by Robert Krulwich, Jad Abumrad, Kurt Braunohler, Reggie Watts, Miriam Gousseau, Glenn Cochi, Darren Gray, Sarah Lipstate, Keith Scratch. Our production team was Melissa O'Donnell, Tom Jeffords, Jill Dubuff, Dave Sanderson, Keith Scratch, and Ellen Horn. Scenic and video design by Josh Higginson and Adam Schweitzer for Workhorse. Endgame by Samuel Beckett, presented through special arrangement with George Burchard, Inc. on behalf of the estate of Samuel Beckett. All rights reserved. Special thanks to Outback Concerts, Nick Nusiforo, Ruth Kreshka, Mary Beth Codel, Jim Burnfield, and Kendra Snyder.
Wow.
All right.
That was a minefield of proper nouns, and you got through it. Congratulations.
Also, while we're in the thank you mood, I want to thank the NPR music team for so graciously agreeing to videotape this performance for us. So thanks to those guys with the cameras that you see floating around.
Radiolab is supported in part by the National Science Foundation and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan.org. Radiolab is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Radiolab is hosted by Jad Abumrad. Our staff includes Ellen Horn, Soren Wheeler, Pat Walters, Tim Howard, Brenna Farrell, Molly Webster, Melissa O'Donnell, Jamie York, Dylan Keefe, Lynn Levy, and Andy Mills, with help from Matt Kelty, Kelsey Padgett, Ariana Wack, Damian Marchetti, and of course, Scott Brown, doing pro bono credit recitation tonight.
That's you.
That's you.
You should know your own name.
Give it up for Scott Brown.